The interns start a fight club, Death and Dai reunite, and Denny is back, kind of. All that and more in a special double-sized edition of the official Grey's Anatomy podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. We may have been gone for a week, but that's okay, because executive producers Shonda Rhimes and Betsy Beers are here with us to gush about the last two episodes, Rise Up and These Ties That Bind, which means a whole lot of talk about a whole lot of things, including Denny, Denny, and more Denny. They'll also hint at what happens in our next episode, In the Midnight Hour, which airs this coming Thursday, November 20th at 9 p.m. on ABC and is available the next day at abc.com. Here now are Shonda and Betsy.
Hi.
Hello, it's Betsy.
And Shonda.
And this is Grey's Anatomy.
Grey's Anatomy.
Wow, it's...
It's been a little while.
It's been a little while. We haven't actually done this for a couple of weeks, have we?
We've been kind of busy.
We've been kind of busy.
Making shows.
We've been just running around making shows, occasionally eating lunch.
And voting.
What? By the way, we voted.
We voted.
And look what happened.
Look what happened.
There was some voting and some change.
And democracy occurred in a great many ways and places.
Which is really, really pretty incredible. And there was a better turnout ever than like in the history since like Lincoln or something crazy.
Which I like to take credit for.
So anybody who has stories about meeting cute guys at the polls... Did you meet any cute guys at the poll, Shonda?
I did, but then I were having a long conversation, and then a woman showed up, and it turned out to be his wife.
So that doesn't work so well.
It was awkward.
And by the way, if there are recounts or revotes in any of your states, don't forget to vote.
Yes, vote more.
Vote often.
Yes.
As much as you can. So we were busy voting, and you were busy writing like a maniac.
Yes. So we didn't have a chance to talk to you about Rise Up.
Which I think was just a phenomenal episode.
Yeah, this was the episode where Erica Hahn, faced with her patient who lost a heart to Denny Duquette, ends up walking away from the hospital.
It's this horrible moment that you sort of realize with Izzy when the patient shows up. I remember when I first read the script, it dawned on me at the same pace it dawned on Izzy who this guy was.
Yeah.
This sort of horrible, haunting moment of actually facing this horrible thing from the past. And it's also the first time you really, really understand the investment that Han had in this guy, because she was actually willing to take down the whole hospital in order to defend her patient.
The episode's called Rise Up for a Reason. I mean, I love that all these old issues rise up metaphorically and, you know, literally Denny's walking down the hallway. And it's great to sort of have those moments there and then have it come alive.
Seeing Denny again is just pretty great, but also slightly creepy.
Slightly creepy.
But what's he wearing? what's he wearing?
You know, if you watch the show carefully, when Denny died, he was wearing a hospital gown.
Mm-hmm.
When Denny came back to talk to Meredith in season 3, he was wearing black sweatpants and a t-shirt.
Yep.
And I think, like, flip-flops or something that he found uncomfortable.
I believe that's correct.
And so when he came back this time, he said, can I change my clothes? At first I said no, and then he made kind of a charmingly compelling argument for why he should be able to change his clothes, because he's the one who pointed out to me he died in a hospital gown. It's not like he is walking around in the clothes he died in. He said obviously changed his clothes after Meredith drowned herself. Like, where'd you get those clothes? He was like, come on, a guy can change his clothes every once in a while. And it was very sweet and very compelling. And he hugged me when he asked, and so I let him change his clothes.
This is a side note I was going to say to this is, he really wouldn't even have to ask. He just has to stand there and make, like, Denny eyes at you.
Yeah,
he, you would have put him, like, in a diver suit if he asked for it, is my guess.
I tried to find a way to get him in, like, a tuxedo, because I've always, you know, I thought,
you
like,
had a thing about
God.
That. That's right, I remember that.
I really want to see Denny in formal wear. But
that was your marriage fantasy.
Yeah. Jeffrey Dean Morgan is a person.
By the way,
human being.
Lovely person. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily Denny.
Not Denny. Separate
Shares
guy.
Many lovely characteristics, which is he's kind and funny
and charming,
great
and sweet
to be around, and loves his dog.
Yes.
Which is always a good thing, by the way.
But I want to be clear that I am not in any way stalking him.
No.
As you guys can report to the judges later.
Yeah, exactly. So this is on record that there's nothing untoward going on in terms
of that department.
Absolutely not. Well, I had to ask that because that was indeed something we did talk about.
Stalking?
Yes, we always talk about stalking.
Or formal wear. Or his clothes.
Stalking people in formal wear.
His clothes were a big deal. It was very interesting trying to figure out what he would be wearing, and we tried to come up with something that felt like it reminded you of his clothes, because you've only really seen him in clothes a couple, like, actual clothes a couple times, so it reminded you of his clothes, but it wasn't his clothes. But he also looked good in it, like we wanted, but it also felt a little bit sort of magically, which is, you know, cashmere always works. In case you're trying to feel magical at home, apparently.
By the way, think about that for gift giving. If you ever want to actually elevate somebody's magic, buy cashmere.
Yes.
So, you know, he looks yummy, but also, to some degree, it's the way Izzy's imagining him or seeing him, whatever you believe.
Whatever you believe.
And you could believe either one, because she's clearly seeing him, and it doesn't seem like anybody else is seeing him.
Yeah, I always like to talk about this, and for the record, from now on, I'm going to talk about this from Izzy's perspective, because it just makes it easier to stop, for me not to sit and wonder what he is, as much as the fact that Izzy sees him makes him real. Nobody else sees him, which is the problem. That's an issue, but she sees him, and so for her, it's
I feel like
nice
those are the clothes that she sees him in. You know,
that's the clothes that she'd imagine him wearing.
You do sort of say, can he leave the hospital? Is he, like, he seems to be hanging around with the operations.
You start to feel like you're not sure. And when we end the the progression of the first episode is that he, because we're talking about two episodes here, I don't think I'm giving anything away. Progression of the first episode is that he's just appearing, and he's around, and he's not speaking, and it's very scary. I mean, not scary, but, you know, like, what's going on? And maybe she's just having visions of him or having flashes of him in her head.
Yep.
But then at the end of the episode, he speaks, which we love. And then the next episode after that, Ties That Bind, he's speaking, and he's with her, and he's hanging out, and she's really trying to ignore him and try to find a way for him to go away. But we never see him outside the hospital until the very end when he's in her bedroom, which is another step forward. After she burns the sweater.
Which is also just to cross over with the, you know, both episodes is I love the entire story with the Indian and the heart, because it's just, I find it incredibly moving that this guy at a particular moment totally sees and realizes that she's got a ghost and the ghost is in the room.
Yeah.
And that she's desperately trying to figure out an answer for what the hell is going on. And at that time, this guy comes with the entire heart, and he has the heart taken out, and then his heart's beating, which there's no medical explanation for, but there is a medical explanation for, is such a great combination of events. And the progression of Denny basically starting with just seeing, talking, touching, you can only hope what else happens, I think.
The other things that were interesting to me about Rise Up was sort of Lexi and her gathering of corpses, which I thought was, what I loved about it is it's great and it's funny. And all of our characters have that great lunchroom scene where they're working on those corpses and they're eating salad and they're talking about stuff and they're treating the corpses like nothing. And you feel like they're nothing. Like, as an audience member, you're sort of like,
they're corpses. Yeah,
that's funny. They're eating, you know,
salad over
the corpses.
The guy.
Until you see poor Ed and Rosie, the older couple with the husband who won't stop pumping the heart, and she dies. And then Bailey finds those corpses just lying about with food dishes on top of them and says, each one of these people was somebody. And I love that moment that you come to realize the things that you take for granted. And I wanted it to be that way for us. I mean, at home we don't normally take corpses for granted. I certainly don't. And I don't think you do.
No, I kind of agree with you on that one.
But if you were a surgeon, you would. And I thought it was very interesting to take something, make it feel a little bit light and funny, and then to really humanize it in that way was lovely.
Well, and then turn around. And like the interns, we haven't paid any attention to them. And I felt as bad when Bailey yelled at me as I did when she yelled at the interns, because I wasn't paying any attention to the corpses.
Exactly.
The whole storyline of Ed and Rosie, I found that so incredibly moving, and I think for both Derek and for Bailey, it has different kinds of resonance. You know, I think for Derek to actually see a couple that has endured this long, that loves each other like this, it's so much about it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, it's so much about his future
and the way he wants to feel and tolerance involved.
And the tolerance involved of, you know, Meredith on the phone in the middle of the night with Christina reading the Harry Potter books that are her mother's journals.
Such a funny reference, I know.
But I love that because it feels sweet. And I love his fix, which is so boy.
Yep. To distract the other chick.
If I can just get her involved with someone else, perhaps I can have my girlfriend all to myself.
And also, by the way, just for the record, the worst possible pairing.
Yes.
Kind of in the history of television to me is Christina and Mark Sloan.
Which is what made it so funny.
Which is what's so great. And also
because
that she has no idea what he's doing.
What I love is it's not just that. It's like she's kryptonite to all of his powers. he's not even good at flirting with her, really, because she's just not giving him anything to go on or anything to work from. Like, she's like a wall for him. And I love the moment when she realizes that he was flirting on her, and it's sort of ridiculous.
Also, just for the record, Ed and Rosie's played by Bonnie Bartlett,
who... Yes.
That's a little bit of a nod to St. Elsewhere, which is a show that I think is phenomenal and we all love over here. But mm-hmm. she was, of course, William Daniels' wife and is in real life and did a phenomenal job, as did George Coe, who's done a bunch of stuff, including Private
yes.
Practice,
yes.
and is a phenomenal actor. And I just
wonderful
think that they're...
Actor.
We're really, really lucky here sometimes because we get this quality of performer, and every once in a while we get these people that we just gigantically admire who we get to work with. And yeah. I think this was a couple that we were just totally psyched to have here,
yeah,
too. So
absolutely.
Kind of a nice shout-out to them as well. What about the dummy?
Okay.
That we actually broke.
Let me just say for the record, that dummy, Stan, was played by an actual medical simulation dummy called iStan.
That's correct.
A wildly expensive
Very
piece
expensive.
Of machinery that did all the things that iStan did and probably did them better. And probably would have continued to do them better for some medical school or some medevac training
yes,
program
yes.
or some trauma program.
Yes.
But Stan wasn't really ready for television.
You know what we decide? You had to do takes with Stan.
He was an awesome piece of equipment, but I don't think he was made to be used in the sort of brutalizing way that he was used.
Which is to redo that procedure
well,
58 times.
I think we also drowned him in fake blood because... Basically, Stan bled more than any human being would actually bleed. So we were like, we just kept adding blood.
As I remember, he spurted blood.
I'm not assigning any blame. Should the iStan people be listening to us? Maybe we didn't have anything to do with him drowning in blood.
Maybe actually he's not. There's nothing wrong with iStan.
And if you
maybe
guys,
this is just perception.
And if you guys, you know, feel like you might want to buy an iStan, I highly recommend it. He's kind
by
of
the
awesome.
Way, they're great and they're good to have around the house. And by the way, if you're alone,
I endorse iStan fully.
I totally, totally do. Sit across iStan at dinner.
But poor iStan, we killed that doll.
We did.
We killed
kind of.
Him. But I thought the storyline was hilarious, and we had a lot of fun with the idea that Richard was the man behind the curtain. And we
the
had a lot
of powerful laws.
Yeah,
it's great.
And we worked on that voice, which is actually four voices melded together to make the voice of iStan forever.
I love Owen's whole figuring out that it's Richard, the whole conversation in front of George. And poor George, who just quietly throughout the entire episode is just carving away at iStan to
yeah.
make sure that he can actually fix something.
And he's very funny. I have two favorite moments in the episode. One of them is Owen and Christina, when Owen basically yells at her and says, did you even bother to find out the patient's name?
Ugh.
And Christina closes the door and tells him how her father died.
Yep.
Because he says, you know, it's not all, is that all you care about, winning contests? And she tells him how her father died. And she says that that's why she's good at her job. That's why she wants to be a heart surgeon. And that's why she wins all the contests. And it's such a beautiful moment. And then she leaves the room and Owen calls her a single malt scotch, which I loved. And it's one of the reasons why I love Owen deeply, you know.
But
deeply
we have,
stalkery
but we
way.
Have so many. No, I'm not really stalkery.
I'm stalking Owen.
Oh, okay. Sorry yeah. about that. Apparently, just for the police records, indeed, yes, she is stalking Owen.
Not stalking Denny. Am stalking Owen.
Okay, so that means the stalker... The to-do list of stalkering I was going to do, I'm going to have to switch out.
Exactly.
Because if you're already stalking him, then I've got to find someone else
you
to stalk.
You've got to find somebody else to stalk.
God, I hate this part.
And then my other favorite moment of the episode was with Erica and Callie in the end of the episode.
Oh, it's just great.
When Erica says to her, you can't kind of help people, you can't kind of whatever, and you can't kind of be a lesbian, which is the thing that's been bubbling under the surface for her ever since she basically, in the last episode, sort of told her story about leaves and said, I am gay, I'm gay, I'm so, so gay.
Yep.
Which I thought was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen Erica Hahn do. And so when we got to this point and she says, you can't kind of be a lesbian, and Callie says, yes, I can, you understand what the fundamental problem is between them. And it's incredibly painful.
It's incredibly painful, and also just that I think for Erica Hahn, everything is in black and white. And I think the point that you come to at the end of this episode is, this is a world of gray, no pun intended.
But I also think in just a fundamental way, like, she went through this enormous change.
Yes, she did.
And figured out something, and a light bulb came on. And I think it's got to be really terrifying and upsetting that you take this journey, and then you turn to the person who you thought you took this journey with,
and
they're
just,
basically saying,
I don't know.
I didn't take this journey. I'm still back there.
You're all the way over here.
You're
I'm
all
back
alone,
here.
Which is really frustrating.
And when you finally have that kind of clarity, it's incredibly angering, too.
Yeah. I really felt bad for Erica in that moment, because I thought that was really it was heartbreaking to me.
I feel incredibly sympathetic towards her with the heart patient, and I understand the entire issue and how deeply she felt about it.
I think her heart was broken at a number of levels.
I do too.
Her faith in the hospital.
That's exactly what I was just about to say, is she couldn't walk through those doors again because every single thing she believed to be true wasn't.
Yeah.
And because I think that she has a particular clarity of vision. She knows what she thinks about things.
Yeah.
And she's surrounded by people who don't.
Yes.
The most frustrating
thing. Constantly debating when she clearly knows right from wrong.
And in her head, what those rules are. So
yes.
It's an incredibly sad moment. And it's also incredibly, I think in a weird way, it's very liberating for her because mm-hmm. she actually took a stand as to what she believed. And in this world of waffling, when you think of this woman who started the season by desperately being accused she was a terrible teacher, trying to figure out a way to teach,
yeah.
being incredibly frustrated every turn of the way, it just feels as though Seattle Grace would be a very, very difficult place for her to be.
And also, you know, they're number 12. You know, she's thinking to herself, I don't have to be here. I think that's absolutely right.
I think that's absolutely right.
And I love how it comes around in the end of the next episode in the ties they mm-hmm. find for Callie, who sort of goes through sort of saying, I'm fine, and gets to that moment where she's been holding it all in and holding it all in and holding it all in, and then the guy whose bones she's been building dies, and she just loses it.
Yeah. And that the two people who stay behind are Christina and Sloane.
Yeah.
Which just, I think there's something incredibly moving, both about one of my favorite moments is when Christina says, why don't you guys leave? We got it from here.
Yeah.
And Sloane says it, and then Owen screams, get out.
Yeah.
To everybody.
Yeah.
Which for some reason, it's amazing because the penny finally drops, and you also see how much Callie really did care.
Yeah, you really, really see how much Callie cared.
And how this sort of unresolved quality for Callie, I think, is she thought she could kind of resolve all her problems by building the man's legs.
She could throw herself into her work
yeah.
and everything would be fine. She wouldn't have to think about it.
There's faith in fixing things.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are just some things that couldn't be fixed. And that's the tragedy of the relationship for
yeah.
her. How about a death and die?
Death and die. We named Sadie. We came up with the character, we named Sadie, we talked about it in the room, we had millions of discussions about Sadie, and it wasn't until 3 days later I sat up in bed in the middle of the night and I was like, their names are Death and Die, and felt really good about
it. Did you really?
Yeah, and felt really good about it, because it's that thing of you have this relationship with somebody in which you were a totally different person at a certain point in your life.
Totally.
And you have these different nicknames, like everyone calls Mare Mare, like that's her name. I love that Christina says, her name's not Death, it's Mare. Which is ridiculous. But it's that thing of, like, you have this whole relationship, you are this whole sort of tequila-drinking, bar-hopping kind of girl, which is what Meredith was in those days.
Yep.
And that's how Sadie knows her. And Sadie knows her as they were Death and Die.
See, and what I love is that Meredith is a serial best friender. Like,
yes.
What you realize is that Meredith is a serial best friender. I don't think Christina was. So the thing is when...
No, Christina made for life.
Exactly. And I think Christina sees Sadie show up, and it's a phenomenal affront to Christina because Christina mates for life.
Yeah.
And Meredith survives, which means you go to places, you bond, you care about somebody. It doesn't make the bond any less deep. It's just Meredith's just a survivalist. That's what she's always been. Phone. And we're actually, today we're in Shauna's office, so that
yeah.
means either Miguel or Soné will be picking up the phone instead of Nancy, who normally picks up the phone. So just so you get a picture of what's going on.
That's what's going on.
Also, by the way, Shauna's office is much nicer than my office, so we should be doing it in here all the
time. I redecorated recently to make
it
my office
like
look like
dermatology wing.
Yeah.
And actually, it kind of does. There's
it
a little actually, more orange, but it's good.
It's very dermatology.
But I think it's on a very, very basic level, it's just crushing for Christina. I've got to say, I love this whole wacko thing which is going on with, A, how crazy Lexi is. Because Lexi last week stole a bunch of cadavers. And this
we
is the
established
thing,
last season that
she,
Lexi's
she steals
a little
things
bit of a kleptomaniac.
Too. She yeah. does steal things. But also that the weird thing is...
She is a wild card. She's a loose cannon. You think she's one thing and she's another. She is just off the rails all the time.
She's way more hardcore. So this whole idea that these interns are in a room cutting each other and then practicing stitches, which by the way... Is based on fact.
Is based on a story. Is based on some stories we were told by some doctors who shall remain nameless, yes.
But apparently this is something that in desperation people do. But what I love about the season is that the season's all about a number 12 teaching hospital because nobody's teaching.
Yes.
So here we get to, you know, episode 7 and 8. And what becomes clear is even though Richard is under the impression that they're building up the teaching hospital and this whole idea of the teaching hospital by bringing in...
Everybody's so busy being out for themselves that the interns are left to teach themselves.
And he's trying to bring in Dr. Dixon, who's a whole nother issue.
Yeah, Dr. Dixon, that was actually amazing because when we came up with the character, I kept saying, wouldn't it be great if Mary McDonald could play this character?
She did this way before we had the character, by the way.
And I kept saying, it's a heart surgeon who has Asperger's and it'll be really interesting. And because what I loved about the idea was there are many parts of Asperger's that suggest that there is a lot of impairment during social interaction, but part of that impairment during social interaction that makes it impossible for you to spend time reading people's emotional cues also makes it possible for you to focus incredibly well on details and facts and things and, you know, as Dixon says, rules, which you could see how that kind of person would be a flawless surgeon. Maybe not so good with patients or with other doctors, but a flawless surgeon because you part of you learns better because you're not bothered by all of the emotional cues that are going on in your life that make all the rest of us spend time wondering how people feel about us or have we been nice enough or should we be sharing our scalpel with somebody else?
Well, it's the elimination of strategy too.
Yeah.
There's no strategizing. So she's simply about the objective, following the objective.
And reaching the objective.
Which is that whole beautiful speech about, I love hearts.
Yes, she loves the color.
Hearts because the color, and then you look at her, which I love, and she's all in red. Which I have always noticed, but just popped the last time I saw it. She's in this amazing red coat with this intense red hat because she loves the color and she loves the ventricles and she loves the fact that there are all these explanations.
And Mary McDonald came to the role with a phenomenal level of just like she'd done all this research and she so wanted to play the character in a true way. And she wanted to make sure that she honored the Asperger's community. And she just really felt strongly about it. And we had lots of discussions about sort of what this character was, what the mannerisms were. And one of the things that ended up happening was we were talking about not sort of being able to figure out the character, and she had this red coat, and I said she should have a little red hat, like a kind of a little girl, like she's been wearing a lot of the same clothes, like she has her comfort levels, and so she has this coat and this red hat that are adorably sweet but a little bit strange on a grown woman.
Well, when she first makes the entrance, the impact of, because nobody really knows her and everybody's really excited to meet her, and then this woman walks in looking like Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
It's hysterical. But it's also...
But she felt like it was something that was oddly comforting to her because it's sort of like her armor. It's how come when she operates, you'll notice that her entire head is covered in a thing, whereas everybody else just wears their surgical cap. Her entire head is covered in this, like, tent-like thing.
Which is more isolating.
Which is more isolating and makes her feel safe.
Her.
So it was just, it was really interesting talking to her and figuring out those ideas of how that character was going to work. And I love the moment when she just shames Bailey, because you rarely see Bailey get shamed like that. It was sort of phenomenal to watch Bailey's face as Dr. Dixon exits the elevator and says, I don't think I like this hospital at all. Intern Fight Club. Intern Fight Clubs, they got some issues, don't you think?
I would those say maybe a little
fight
bit.
Fight Club-y interns. I'm a little worried about what the injection of Sadie into that.
I don't think Sadie's helping. I'm going to be really blunt.
I think Di is not helping at all.
I'm going to say I think Di is a little bit of a loose cannon.
Really? Yeah.
I'm thinking Di is a little bit of a loose cannon.
I'm actually thinking that the mixture of Di and Lexi together.
It's really potent and horrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it looks to me like Di will do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And is fearful of nothing, which is just absolutely both intoxicating to watch and really troubling because this hospital is already on the brink of disaster. And yet you've entered in this character who clearly has seemingly no fear of authority, offending people.
Or pain.
Or danger. Or pain.
Pain.
But it's kind of, the moment when she actually cuts herself and every single guy in the room raises his hand.
It was great.
And Lexi actually looks pissed.
Because Ryan, the actor who plays Ryan, whose name I cannot remember at this exact moment, ad-libs a line that we thought was so great we kept it in the show, which is, he's like, oh, right here. Like, it's just great.
Funny. I also, one of my favorite things about the episode is at the very, very end, Meredith agrees to tell Derek the story.
Like, one of the stories of Death and Die, but they don't tell us, which we love.
Which is great.
We talked a lot about it in the writer's room, and we kept saying, what should the story be? What should the story be? And I told the story in the writer's room about what it was, and then we decided that we were never going to tell the audience, because it made it juicier to not know. And whatever you put in your head and you imagined would probably be more interesting than whatever we said.
Probably, but there is, you do have something in your head.
Yeah, one day maybe we'll tell you, but...
Yeah, you never know. That's exactly. Happened before. It's like there are things that you actually have in the back of your head that you say, I'll never ever tell, and then, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You might end up telling. I mean, look at why Meredith and her mom.
Yeah, I save things for when
we
need
them. You
save
things, exactly. So you may be surprised in ways that you have no idea. It's always a crapshoot.
And then my other favorite moment is the kiss between Christina and Owen in the alley outside the bar.
Oh, dude.
Oh, my God.
I mean, come on. There's nothing even to say about that. That's just ridiculous.
Well, what I love about it is it starts out feeling a little bit violent and a little bit dangerous in a way that's maybe not so good. In a way that makes you think...
This from a woman... who's actually a stalker, is pretty good. But, okay, whatever, fine.
But in a way that's a little bit...
No, it's a little bit...
you a little bit worried about Christina's safety.
And she's and a tiny little thing, so...
Yeah, and and that's the thing that you sort of realize in that alley, is he's a big guy.
Yeah, he is.
And she's sort of a tiny little thing, and she's formidable, but not with him, somehow.
Yeah,
and
no,
And, you know, he's Heathcliff. He's standing on moors and
he
shouting.
He is.
And...
He's fabulous. And, boy, that moment to me is just like this person who is totally in charge, this woman who's totally, like... directed and focused and totally having to give up control.
If anybody else had done that to her, she not only would not have kissed them back, she would
have
kicked
the
crap out of them the minute it was over. There's something about Owen that needs some taking care of.
Yep.
That she sees in a way that nobody else sees. Owen is like this hurt little bird that needs some taking care of, and in a weird way, by the time he comes away from that kiss, he's so much weaker than she is, and she has all of the power in that situation.
Absolutely.
And so she just walks away, which I love.
We can analyze this to death, but come on, it's just hot.
Yeah, it's hot. The next episode is called In the Midnight Hour.
I love this episode. This is what I'm going to say about this episode. This episode is so incredibly good and so incredibly haunting that there's a lot more there than meets the eye, and everybody's going to get pushed.
That's a really good way of putting it. There's a lot happens in this episode. A lot more happens than I think you'd ever expect in this episode.
Absolutely. And I think this is actually one of those crucial episodes to watch in real time. You don't want to actually be behind on this episode. You want to sit and watch it on the television that you have in front of you.
Because it's really good.
So that's pretty much it for us. Shauna's going to go off to her secret stalking position, and I'm going to go try to find something else to do.
This is Shonda.
This is Betsy. This has been Grey's Anatomy.
Grey's Anatomy.
That's it for this double-sized edition of our podcast. Join us next time as we look back at The Midnight Hour. That episode airs this Thursday, November 20th at 9 p.m. on ABC, followed by a not-to-be-missed episode of Life on Mars.